May it please the court, counsel. I'm Attorney Dana Duncan of Wisconsin Rapids. I represent Lynn Larson today. Four issues have been presented to the court. The ALJ's failure to afford proper consideration to the opinion of the treating psychologist, the ALJ's failure to afford controlling weight to an unrefuted opinion of Dr. Daniel Lokman regarding physical limitations. The ALJ's credibility findings are also, it is alleged, unsupported by the record, and the ALJ provided an incomplete hypothetical question.
You mean treating psychiatrist? Is it Dr. Rhodes we're talking about?
With regard to the incomplete hypothetical question.
For your first point, I thought that...
Dr. Rhodes, yes.
Who is an MD, a psychiatrist, right?
Psychiatrist. Okay. After a long history of depression, Lynn Marie Larson was raped in January of 2004 and suffered more mental limitations. She carries a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, and depression. Despite a significant treatment history and despite the report of her treating psychiatrist indicating that her impairments were severe and limiting, the ALJ determined that her condition was not severe enough and she was denied a period of supplemental security income.
Is your primary argument that if Dr. Rhodes' opinion were given the proper weight that she'd actually qualify under the listings, or that this is a step five case that was erroneously adjudicated because of the hypothetical?
Both. Dr. Rhodes indicated that she met the listing under the C criteria. Dr. Rhodes also indicated limitations that would equate to a step five claim. Also, Dr. Rhodes indicated that she would not be able to work in a sustained work setting and would miss three or more days per month, all of which would qualify her for Social Security.
What evidence do we have here showing repeated episodes of decompensation?
Well, the term decompensation in the regulations or in the listings themselves defines decompensation as a change or a significant change.
What evidence are you relying upon?
Well, in this particular case, the fact that she continually needed a period of several years where she was constantly undertaking medication adjustments in order to continue to function. The
fact that she is your position that that's enough to establish decompensation for listing purposes?
It would be, but we don't need to even achieve the listing purpose for decompensation because decompensation falls under the B criteria.
What does decompensation mean? I can't figure it out.
It's
like gibberish.
It's generally... there's a definition, but again, it's kind of
What does it mean? Can't you be concrete?
The listing specifies that decompensation.
You tell me what you think it means.
Well, decompensation, Judge, in my opinion, dealing with hundreds of claimants a year, would be...
I don't understand why it's a matter of opinion. It's some kind of medical term. It must have a meaning of some sort. It's tossed around in these cases. I don't have any idea what it means.
Well, there's if a claimant is placed into a mental institution, if a claimant has periods where they're not able to function in a normal everyday daily activity setting.
Going to the bathroom and crying while you're on the job. I mean, on page 30 of your brief, you have a definition from the Code of Federal Regulations. And we do have evidence in this case from the friend that she worked for that she'd work a little while and then she'd have to go hide out in the restroom or she'd break down crying for a while or whatever. I'm just looking at this. Exacerbations or temporary increases in symptoms or signs accompanied by a loss of adaptive functioning.
What I don't understand is, so people have mental illness. They're not sort of raving maniacs all the time. They have good days and bad days. This is something these ALJs don't understand, but this is pretty obvious. Is that all decompensation means? Means you're having a bad day?
Well, it's more than just a bad day. It's a prolonged period where there are several bad days.
Well, what do you mean prolonged period? Because the phrase in this regulation, episodes of decompensation, what is, episode sounds short. I don't understand. I don't understand all this language. What they're trying to say is that if you have mental illness and it hits you, you don't like depression, it hits you from time to time. It's not continuous. But if you have a protracted depressed episode or anxiety or what have you, that's serious. So, is that all they mean by decompensation? You have a bad period, you know, where your mental illness is really interfering with your life, and it's protracted. It's not like 5 minutes of feeling frightened or something like that.
Correct, Judge. And a psychologist that I greatly respect has used the term a prolonged period of decompensation, meaning that an individual is treated, continues to be treated and has problems where medication needs to be readjusted, continues to have problems functioning on a daily basis, and does so over a period of time, that is sufficient to arrive at a decompensation.
Who is that psychiatrist you're relying on?
His own opinion.
Who is it that you're referring to?
Just a treating source that Dr. Lace, Michael Lace out of...
Somebody you know.
Yes.
Mr. Duncan, I've got to ask you about a phrase in your brief. Page 31. You wrote, the decompensation element should have been satisfied. Whether the enemy knew and understood the definition of decompensation cannot be gleaned from this record. Who is the enemy you're referring to there?
I apologize, Judge. Obviously, that's a typo.
It's not a typo. To whom do apologies go in this instance?
Well, the term should have been the...
Would you agree with me that it is completely inappropriate in civilized legal discourse?
Yes.
And your apologies are directed to whom?
To the court and to everybody that...
To the ALJ, to
the commissioner?
Yes.
This is not helpful.
So there are a number of points in your brief, actually, if we're on the subject, where I have the impression that perhaps this was dictated and not proofread, because there's another one on page 35 where it says Larson was too full and depressed. And I think you might have meant tearful, but I would urge you to take more care.
Yes, Judge. In this particular case, the key issue...
Here you have another funny one on the next page. It appears even when her condition was waning,
yes,
mental health remained problematic. Page 36. That's a mysterious use of waning.
Should be waning.
Waning, okay. Thank you.
Treating physician's opinion is entitled to controlling weight as long as it's supported by the issues and or by objective medical evidence is consistent with the substantial evidence on the record. The evidence in this case, Judge, falls primarily on what constitutes a good reason. In this case, what is appropriate contrary evidence to rebut the controlling or substantial weight that is to be afforded a treating source. Unfortunately, ALJs and reviewing courts have mistakenly believed too often that the reason is that any reason is sufficient to establish grounds to minimize a treating source statement. Here we have Larson's, the ALJ cited the ability of Larson to care for her children, to manage her household, to include doing cooking, household chores, and laundry, to have a relationship with two friends, to work on a part-time basis for her friend, Paul, and that she had waxing and waning symptoms. What actual impact do any of these have on the treating source statement? Dr. Rhodes, the ALJ, and the medical examiner at hearing, Dr. Stephen Carter, all indicated that there were mild restrictions in the activities of daily living. These functions that are cited, for the most part, are activities of daily living. So it would only stand to reason that if she has minimal or mild limitations, some of these activities could be performed. They're not excluded. Possibly the good relationship with two friends and working for a friend, Paul, may have some impact regarding Dr. Rhodes' opinion regarding social functioning, but this is misguided also because Dr. Rhodes and the ALJ both found moderate limitations in social functioning, so they are in agreement as to how the limiting nature of her relationships.
What is the business with the ice on the ankle? I don't understand that. What does she need to do with her ankle?
She needs to continually ice the ankle.
What do you mean by continually ice?
She needs to be able to stop periodically, obtain fresh ice.
Periodically, how often?
It doesn't specify, Judge. The doctor's limitations.
Is the idea she has to have ice continuously on her ankle?
For the most part, she has to be able to go and obtain ice and ice the ankle.
How often?
It doesn't specifically say, Judge.
What is it that doesn't specifically say?
The doctor's opinion.
Okay, well, thanks.
Could I just ask one quick question, Mr. Duncan? Could you, Dr. Lockman's opinion concerning the ankle, how did the ALJ, did the ALJ reject that opinion?
Yes.
How?
Just,
I thought he said 4 hours with 30 minutes off. I thought that was consistent with Dr. Lockman's opinion.
Well, the question is in what manner and means. For instance, if the normal pattern of 4 hours would encompass a normal type of job where somebody is afforded those breaks at the periodic instances, a normal work day, 8 to 5, if the individual were limited at, and allowed a break at 9:30, noon for lunch, and 3 o'clock in the afternoon, then the ALJ's findings are consistent. If that individual is not afforded within that time frame, within that window, then they would be not consistent. And there are
But an 8-hour work schedule with a half-hour break at lunch would accommodate that, in his opinion, correct?
Depending on when you have the lunch break afforded. If it's in the middle of the day, yes. But if it's not, it's not.
Okay. Thanks for indulging.
Okay, of course. Mm-hmm. So, Mr. Sorkin?
May it please the Court, my name is Adam Sorkin, and I represent the Commissioner of the Social Security Administration. The Commissioner's final determination that Lynn Larson was not disabled was entitled, the Commissioner's final determination that Lynn Larson was not disabled and not entitled to supplemental security income was well supported by the substantial evidence. I want to start with...
It's well supported because, I mean, whether you squeak by the substantial evidence test is another matter, but... It really seems to me that there isn't very much engagement with Dr. Rhodes' opinions, and the fact that the little amount of work she does is with, you know, running off to the bathroom to hide, or this isn't just getting nervous around strangers. This is pretty serious inability to deal with the world.
And the ALJ discounts somewhat Dr. Rhodes's December 2005 medical impairment questionnaire.
It's not just Dr. Rhodes. It's her account. It's her friend Paul Kelly's account. It's Dr. Rhodes' account. I mean, I'm not seeing a real grappling with the facts, not just from one source, but from a number of different sources.
The ALJ accounts for the fact that she has this fear of strangers.
He says on page 7 of 9 of his opinion, this is when Paul Callies is testifying, she needs to take breaks and gets nervous. He says, I note, however, that the claimant is apparently able to successfully work for Mr. Callies, provided she is not required to interact with strangers or stand for prolonged periods. I don't know where that sentence comes from. Certainly not from anything Mr. Callies said. And she didn't work very many hours, and she's in the bathroom half the time. So
he contradicts himself in two sentences down. The claimant, she went to work twice a week for 4 hours at a time. Well, that's not exactly evidence that you're not disabled.
Your Honor, the ALJ notes that she had a few different part-time jobs. That job refers to her job as a gas station attendant, that she was working 4 hours at a time for 2 days a week. She also worked at Mr. Callie's bar restaurant. She was both a wait person.
He's a
as
friend,
well as a
right? That's a problem. We've had that case in the we've dealt with this situation in the past.
She also
you have a very indulgent employer who allows you to work. You may still be totally disabled because you can't count on people like that, right?
Yeah, she also worked as a Head Start bus driver for 24 hours a week for a period of 3 months.
And then she was fired for behavior that, you know, was completely unacceptable for somebody with that kind of serious responsibility. I mean, I thought that your counting that as a plus was rather surprising, to tell you the truth.
Well, I think that it undercuts the fact that Dr. Rhodes says that she has marked impairments in concentration, pace, and persistence. If you look
why does it contradict that? Since, as Judge Posner said, maybe she can concentrate for 2 weeks, but it turns out that, you know, over any sustained period of time, she really can't.
This was a period of 3 months that she worked for Head Start. She got great performance evaluations.
See,
they told her.
ALJ, like many people, he seems to think that if you're not continuously behaving in some nutty way, you're not disabled.
I think what the ALJ's opinion reflects is the fact that that this mental impairment questionnaire by Dr. Rhodes in December of 2005 was not consistent with the rest of Dr. Rhodes's treating notes.
But if you look at Dr. Rhodes's notes, if you read your brief, one would get the impression that her GAF score was 70 most of the time.
It was 70 on one occasion.
In fact, there was only one occasion when it was 70. The rest of the time it's between 50 and 55. There are a lot of 55s in there.
And there
so
was
there's one moment that it's a 70.
There was a 55 on 12 of 18 appointments. So two-thirds of the time, Dr. Rhodes found only moderate symptoms or limitations.
No, he does not, though. He uses adjectives, but he then puts a GAF score that's very low.
On only five of those appointments does he characterize her effect as blunted or non-appropriate. On the rest of the times, he notes there's 13 appointments where he notes that she has full and appropriate affect, that she has euthymic or normal, non-depressed mood.
And then he still puts the GAF score down. I mean, so she's being pleasant, you know. And here's where I was looking for. In your brief, at the bottom of page 15, you say she testified she was fired from her part-time job as a bus driver in 2005 because she had a nervous breakdown and took mind-altering medications. And then your footnote tries to rehabilitate this by pointing out that the Indian Community Action Agency that employed her denied firing her. They say they just put her on probation after her emotional breakdown. Well, it seems to me that corroborates that there was an emotional breakdown. Again, it's not just her word for it.
Well, I'd like to touch on this issue of decompensation because, with all due respect to Mr. Duncan, I don't
think. What do you think it means?
Well, I'm going to go based on what the listing says,
I don't understand the listing, okay. So you'll have to put it into English.
Okay, so the listing says that there are.
I'm not interested in what the listing says. I'm interested in your conception of decompensation.
My conception is it must be a period of an exacerbation of symptoms.
You're reading the thing. Would you please put it in your own
it
words?
It must be accompanied by a loss.
What
of,
is it? What is it?
Function.
Explain
complete,
what it is.
It's a complete breakdown of extended duration of at least 2 weeks where you can essentially not do much of anything, where you must be in either a mental hospital or a halfway house or have some sort of supportive environment because you are that completely unable to do anything.
What if you're just sitting at home watching TV because you can't move off your couch?
We don't have the evidence here to suggest that that's what happens.
I don't know. I'm asking whether that would satisfy, whether you actually have to have the money to go to a hospital or whether if you're just sitting at home paralyzed on your TV.
I think that would suggest that you wouldn't be able to cook for yourself, to get food. You wouldn't be able to just subsist in your home.
Yeah, that's going too far. Come on.
The agency, you know, Dr. Rhodes in his mental impairment questionnaire says that she's likely to have three or more episodes of this in 1 year. And there's no support for that. He doesn't offer any support for that in his questionnaire. There's
but
no evidence.
He's a psychiatrist. I mean, you're not talking about somebody who's, you know, a cardiologist or something who's talking about the need to put a defibrillator in or something where there's objective physical evidence. A psychiatrist has to make these kind of predictive judgments.
But, Your Honor, the ALJ didn't find that this assessment was corroborated by the rest of his treatment notes and the rest of the evidence precisely because he doesn't really offer any support. He doesn't explain when given the opportunity.
What's the ALJ looking for? That's what
I think the ALJ is looking for more.
He puts her on every drug known to man, so
he frequently adjusts her medication, but for issues related to sleep and to stomach aches, not because she is decompensating.
No, some of the drugs she's getting have nothing to do with sleep or stomach aches.
Certainly, but there's some adjustment in her medication
for her side
effects.
So why do you think
he's
prescribing all this medication for? Is he irresponsible?
No, I'm not. I don't think I'm suggesting that at all, Your Honor. I think what I'm suggesting is that the medication is to treat her depression, and it treats her depression effectively. For the most part, she's able to maintain a pretty rich ability to function daily.
What is this business about the two friends? I found that very mysterious.
He says that she has, Dr. Rhodes in his questionnaire says, and I should note that this.
How does that bear on mental illness?
One of the B criteria is ability to function socially. And the ALJ here is saying, well, she's got a pretty rich ability to function.
Function socially? That's completely different. That means your ability to be in a crowd, be with other people, be with strangers, you know, that's socially, even insane people, you know, have family. They may have a couple of close friends. There's nothing.
And she's able to take care of her five children, to run a household.
Mr. Sorkin, let me try to come at this from a slightly different angle. It seemed to me that one of the critical findings to support the ALJ's finding was his conclusion that Ms. Larson suffers from only moderate impairments in social functions.
Yes.
We've got Dr. Rhodes saying it's marked. We've got other evidence that suggests it's marked. Where did the moderate finding come from other than just the non-examining state psychiatrist, the guy who just looked at her records?
It comes from that. I think it comes from the fact that the ALJ didn't find that Dr. Rhodes' assessment was completely credible because it didn't comport with the rest of his treatment.
So that's just the ALJ's own discount?
The ALJ says that he's giving it some weight. He also accounts for these.
Where did he say he was discounting the psychiatrist's testimony?
He says on, give me one moment.
7 of 9.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. He says that he's given some weight to the opinions of the treating psychiatrist. However, his assessment of the severity of the claimant's symptoms is not corroborated by the record as a whole.
Well, what in the record is it?
He doesn't say what.
Well, he talks to some extent
right
about.
There, he doesn't. He just zips on and says, "I've also considered the opinions of the state agency medical consultants."
He references claimant's normal activities.
Yeah, but what's the? I don't see any inconsistency between the normal activities paragraph, which is the one above, and the psychiatrist's testimony, right?
Well, the psychiatrist on this form, which is in a form that the attorney sent him, it wasn't a treatment note in any way. The ALJ looks more to Dr. Rhodes' treatment notes where he sees...
Where does he say anything about Dr. Rhodes' treatment notes?
Well, he talks about the fact that he includes the above-referenced evidence, and that relates to claimants...
No, that's the normal activities stuff.
And part of her normal activities is that for the... The vast majority of her visits to Dr. Rhodes, she has a non-depressed mood.
You're talking about that. The only reference to treatment notes up at the top of 7, psychiatrist treatment notes reflect waxing and waning symptoms depending on various situational stressors. Okay, that's fine.
And those...
Why is that inconsistent with anything in Rhodes' report? It's not explained.
Rhodes essentially says that she's completely disabled, and when you look at Rhodes' treatment notes, you see that there's these short periods of time where she has depressive symptoms that are well accommodated by the RFC here, and that for the vast majority of her visits, she's not experiencing.
What is he talking? I've given some weight to the opinion of the treatment. Look, this is all, and of course he has this ridiculous boilerplate, which I suppose is never going to get out of these opinions. You know, at the bottom of page 6, this is every single ALJ opinion.
Finding that she is not entirely credible?
This paragraph is in every ALJ opinion. It's a piece of boilerplate. Don't you realize that?
I realize that similar language comes up in other opinions, yes. And I think that in this case... His credibility
it's
determination.
Just a fog of words. There's no engagement. He doesn't say this is what Rhodes said. This is what the treatment notes say. They're inconsistent. There isn't anything like that.
He does describe the treatment notes of Dr. Rhodes on page 3 in that first long paragraph. He goes through the fact that she had treatment, that she didn't stay in psychotherapy very long, that she had some side effects. And he discusses, her testimony, her daily activities.
He mentions the GAF score of 55. He mentions the second psychiatrist also assesses the GAF score of 55.
And that second psychiatrist, when she goes to him...
And then he also says GAF scores were generally assessed as 50 or 55. So it's linking together those things. It's like he forgets that he wrote that paragraph by the time he gets further on.
I think that paragraph is entirely consistent with the finding that she is not disabled, that those indicate moderate impairments that he accommodates by restricting her to work that doesn't include crowds, that doesn't include much contact with coworkers or with the public, and that he recognizes that there are these short periods where she is moderately depressed.
It falls apart, actually.
I think that there's... one instance where she testifies that she falls apart, and there's not much evidence in the record looking at Dr. Rhodes' treatment notes or looking at her psychotherapy notes that she falls apart. And
you can't even tell who he's talking about, right? Since there are two psychiatrists. He never uses the name.
She goes to Dr. Nomi only twice.
He never uses the name. Isn't that odd?
But
he never names the psychiatrist.
But from his opinion,
yeah,
we can tell.
So you're conducting, some exegesis as if we were dealing with some fragmentary hieroglyphic text.
I don't think we can divorce the ALJ's opinion from the record that we have in front of us, and we can determine which psychiatrist he's talking about when. And at that very last appointment where she sees a psychiatrist, he asks her if she has no complaints, and she says if she has any complaints, and she says no, I'm doing okay. And I think that that's indicative of the fact that when she's feeling okay, which is the majority of the time, she's feeling pretty okay. And there's short periods where she's not.
To be feeling okay a majority of the time, if you're nuts 49% of the time, you're not going to be holding down a job.
She's shown through 3 part-time jobs that she can hold down a job. And in the worst of her circumstances, the ALJ accommodates that with very restrictive activities that she can do. And the VE limits her to the sorts of jobs like package handler, which doesn't involve people, which involves unskilled, light labor that's in a low-stress environment that's very repetitive. Those are the
you
sorts
think
of
that's low stress?
I've never
I
been a package
you
handler.
I bet you haven't worked as a package handler.
You're right, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Sorkin.
I would ask that you affirm the Commissioner's decision.
Right. And Mr. Duncan, does he have any time? Oh, you can have a minute if you have anything important.
In rebuttal, one point I wanted to make is that the ALJ's use of this part-time work really does not equate with an ability to work full-time. the law clearly evidences that you may have to be able to work in a sustained work setting, which is defined as 40 hours a week, 8 hours a day, 5 days in a row. And if you can't do that, then under step 5, you are disabled. So to claim that somehow part-time work equates with an ability over a long period of time to work, there's numerous case law which clearly establishes that absences of more than 3 days per month preclude an individual from competitive employment. So all we need to do is establish that she has periods of depression or symptoms which prevent her from reporting to work a couple of days, 3 days out of a month, 3 days out of the normal 20, and she would be disabled.
Do I understand correctly, Mr. Duncan, that her work record was so fragmentary that she did not qualify for disability insurance benefits?
That is correct. That's why she is going for SSI.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Duncan and Mr. Sorkin.